Good evening, everyone. I'm Ed Whalen, the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I'm delighted to welcome you to this second event in our American Culture and Democracy lecture series. We had a great event last week with Justice Scalia addressing the crisis of the courts, and it's good to see so many of you who attended that event back again today. Before I introduce this evening's very distinguished speaker, I'd like to call your attention to our upcoming events. Next week, we're not going to do the Monday Night Football lead-in next week. It's going to be on Friday next week. Friday, October 8th, Professor Hadley Arkus will address the question of marriage. And in the weeks after that, George Weigel and Bill Kristol will explore the war against terrorism. Eric Cohen and Leon Kass will examine the bioethics debate. And Professor Wilfred McClay and Christine Rosen will probe American culture and the presidency. As you can see, these lectures focus on key issues that deeply divide our culture. And we hope very much that you find the lectures interesting and enlightening. Now, before I introduce our speaker, I ask that you turn off any cell phones or other beeping devices. We're very honored to have as our speaker today Father Richard John Newhouse. Father Newhouse, as I'm sure most of you already know, is one of the leading thinkers on matters involving religion and public life. Among other things, he is the editor-in-chief of the outstanding journal First Things and the author of many influential books, including The Naked Public Square, Religion and Democracy in America. Father Newhouse will speak to us today on the unresolvable conflict, religion, politics, and morality. Thank you, Father Newhouse.
Thank you, Ed. It's a privilege to be here at Ethics and Public Policy for the beginning of, or near the beginning of this lecture series. And at the new beginning of an era for ethics and public policy under the leadership of Ed Whalen, I am confident that this institution will not only continue, but will magnify its great work in bringing people together around questions such as religion, politics, and morality. Now, I think it was Ed who suggested early on that maybe to say the unresolvable conflict is a bit too strong, perhaps. And perhaps that's right. It is more precisely among these three dynamics and the institutionalization of these dynamics, it is more precisely an inherent tension, but a tension that in both logic and in historical experience frequently results in conflict, so much so that one might almost say the conflict is inevitable. And this is not necessarily to be deplored. While in the American constitutional order we should seek cooperation and accommodation, the fact is that tension and conflict can be a sign of democratic vitality. And we should be worried when we are not publicly worrying about the interaction between religion, politics, and morality. Toward the end of this reflection, I will touch on one eruption of that tension become conflict in the current round of troubles that has understandably gained a good deal of public interest, having to do with the bishops and certain Catholic politicians. But to the larger question, if conflict is not too strong, then the question is the word unresolvable in the title, is that not perhaps too strong? And I think we have to say no, it's not. For in the Christian view of things, the tension and the conflict will only be resolved in the end time, when, as St. Paul writes to the Philippians, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. But that end time is not yet. We are the people living between the times, between the time of the inauguration of the rule of Christ and his triumph over sin and death, and the consummation of that rule in the promised kingdom of God. Only then, in the promised kingdom, will the tension and the conflict be definitively resolved. The great danger throughout the history of the West and throughout the history of Christianity has been to attempt to resolve that tension prematurely. There's a great danger politically, religiously, and morally to attempt a resolution before the end time. That attempt has been the source of immeasurable misery and tyranny and slaughter over the centuries, and not least of all in the century just past. In the second century marvelous letter to Diognetus that I'm sure many of you remember, written by we don't know whom to a person named Diognetus who was curious about who those Christians were. And in the letter to Diognetus, it is said that for Christians, quote, every foreign country is a homeland, and every homeland is a foreign country. Every foreign country is a homeland, every homeland a foreign country. In the 5th century, St. Augustine, who was, I would suggest, much more of a Roman and much more hopeful about the future of the Roman Empire and the claim that it made morally upon the Christian conscience than is generally thought, St. Augustine in the 5th century finished his great City of God, in which he depicted the chosen people of God, Israel. Israel become the church on their pilgrim way to the kingdom. And as Augustine viewed that, the City of God lives through history, entangled and intermixed, sometimes in a very ambiguous and confused way, with the temporal orders of what he called the City of Man. All temporal orders, Augustine underscored, are riddled through and through with human sinfulness. They are, in truth, radically disordered, because their loves are wrongly directed. All temporal orders are marked by what he just called the libido dominandi, the lust for power and for glory. Now for him, writing about the temporal order, he had before him chiefly the Roman Empire. For us, it is constitutional democracy. And of course, these orders are very different in many ways. But the problems and the ambiguities and the conflicts and the tensions are not all that different for us than they were for Augustine. What we today call the question of church-state relations is addressed with great sophistication in the City of God, and especially in Book 19. And so these tensions, these conflicts, are in no way new. They are fundamentally grounded in the claims of rival sovereignties. And here, of course, the essential text is Matthew 22, "Render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." Then and now, the chief temptation is to render to Caesar what belongs to God. The church's posing of a competing sovereignty to Caesar is the very root of the discovery of the political possibility of liberty Fareed Zakaria in his recent and important book, The Future of Freedom, speaks about the tension posed in Matthew 22 as the first important source of liberty in the West and hence in the world. The tension between Christ and Caesar. And keep in mind that for all our talk and theorizing about democracy, Caesar is still the appropriate word. There are still the rulers and the ruled. That will always be the case, always has been the case. And all the legitimate modifications and permutations represented by the democratic experiment have not changed that fundamental fact of the rule, the ruler and the ruled, of Caesar, if you will. The tension between Christ and Caesar is the source of liberty and is the source of pluralism in the ordering of society. It places a check upon the monopolistic drive of the libido dominandi, of the lust for power and glory, that exists in any and in every temporal order. The alternative to pluralism is monism. And the most aggressive monisms of the past century we generally called and call totalitarianism. But monism, the alternative to pluralism, has taken many forms through history. Religious, political, moral. There is the monism of Dostoevsky's Cardinal and Brothers Karamazov, the Grand Inquisitor, you recall, who imprisoned Christ and forbade him to return, lest he excite the people's vain dreams of freedom. There is the monism today of a few Christians, and it would seem most Muslims, to reconstitute the social and political order in explicit obedience to what they believe to be the revealed law of God, establishing the kingdom before the kingdom. There is the sectarian monism among some Christians, stemming from the 16th century Anabaptist tradition, that would establish a church of true believers unsullied by entanglement with what is condemned as, quote, the world. And then, of course, there were the unspeakable horrors of aggressively anti-Christian monisms, such as Marxism's dream of the kingdom of freedom, and Hitler's thousand-year Reich. All of these monisms, as well as many other forms, have in common an unwillingness to wait for the kingdom of God or a denial of its promise. All are efforts, sometimes very bloody efforts, to displace the city of God with a new and all-encompassing city of man that would satisfy our desires for the absolute. Discussions of totalitarianism frequently neglect the very real possibility of democratic totalitarianism. Wiser students of democracy, such as Tocqueville and A.D. Lindsay and Christopher Dawson, were keenly aware of the dangers of democratic tyranny. The modern state in the West, later to become the modern democratic state, claimed to be rescuing humanity from the wars of religion of the 16th and 17th century, while all the while demonstrating the state's insatiable appetite for the comprehensive control of society, if of a democratic bent, comprehensive control in the name of, quote, the people. The democratic Caesar's impatience with any rival sovereignty was pronounced and explicit, of course, in the case of the French Revolution, which indeed presented itself as a new religion, claiming the ultimate and exclusive allegiance of the people. Much wiser, much more modest, were the American founders, who, although flirting with hubris in declaring their work a novus ordo seclorum, a new order for the ages, nonetheless held themselves accountable to transcendent authority, to authority beyond their own contriving. And thus the declarations appeal to nature and nature's God. Most importantly, and without precedent in all of human history, in the first liberty of the First Amendment, they did what no other government in all of human history had ever done, and that is declared its incompetence to demand or control the ultimate allegiance of its citizens. The free exercise of religion, the first clause of the First Amendment, is, I think it fair to say, I think it necessary to say, the most important single contribution of the American experiment to humanity's quest for a free and just political order. Although, of course, the phrase was adopted much, much later, the genius of that experiment is encapsulated in the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance, which means, first of all, a nation under the judgment of and holding itself accountable to an authority, a transcendent authority, to which or to whom the people are free to appeal against every threat of tyranny. As Madison wrote in his Memorial and Remonstrance, one's obligation to God is precedent in both time and authority to one's obligation to the civil community. And not only Madison, but in diverse ways, almost all, if not all, of the American founders subscribed to that fundamental truth of the novelty, of the audaciousness, of the experiment that they were launching. Yet the American experiment in grounding liberty by an acknowledgement of rival sovereignties is by no means secure. Beginning after World War II and led by the Supreme Court, the first clause of the First Amendment was turned on its head, and the no establishment provision was deemed again and again to trump the free exercise of religion, the free exercise of religion being the entire purpose of the religion clause. A clause intended to check the states, and by the way, it is but one clause, not two clauses, not an establishment clause and a free exercise clause. Grammatically and in manifest intention, it is one clause. And it is a clause intended to check the state's ambition to exercise exclusive sovereignty. It in no way proposes any check or any limit upon religion whatsoever. The check, the limit, is upon what the state may do. Congress shall, etc. A clause intended to check the state's ambition to exercise exclusive and therefore almost certainly tyrannical sovereignty was increasingly interpreted to prevent any challenge to that exclusive sovereignty. Step by step, we have moved from principled pluralism to a relentless monism that I have elsewhere described as the naked public square. This year, 2004, marks the 20th anniversary of the book by that title. And I have been, for the first time, compelled to actually go back and read or reread the book by a number of academic conferences and so forth that are being held to mark the occasion. Rereading it, I discovered, has not been an embarrassing experience, although the 20 years since then as an editor has done something to my sensibilities in reacting to the prolixity of the book and the repetitiousness of the argument. But there you are. The naked public square means what? It's politics and public life divested of and divorced from moral judgment, and especially religiously grounded moral judgment. And especially religiously grounded moral judgment democratically expressed by the sovereign people, the politically sovereign people. 20 years later, there is a greater awareness of the danger that I am describing. But what has happened is deeply entrenched in our political culture and even more radically asserted in what is aptly called the judicial usurpation of politics. Here one need only cite Supreme Court decisions of recent years. Romer, Lawrence, and above all, Roe v. Wade and its judicial offspring. All are premised upon the logic, explicitly premised upon the logic of a radical monism that will tolerate no challenge from morality, conscience, tradition, or religion, no matter how democratically that challenge is posed. Such is the increasingly illiberal liberalism of the naked public square. The alternative, and I've had to say this on so many occasions over the years, it is so often misunderstood, the alternative to the naked public square is not the sacred public square, but the civil public square. The civil public square makes possible authentic politics. As Aristotle would teach us, if we ask the question, what is politics? The answer is politics is free persons deliberating the question, how ought we to order our life together? And the ought in that understanding of politics makes clear that the exercise that we call politics is moral in nature, not always, not even often moral in practice, to be sure, but moral in nature. The enterprise itself is a moral enterprise. In our constitutional order, democratic deliberation and decision is to be effected, of course, by indirect and representative means. But it is always the exercise of the political sovereignty of the we, the people, who are always free to appeal to a sovereignty that transcends their own. When deliberation and decision about how we ought to order our life together excludes the moral convictions of the people, when the moral convictions of the people are deemed to be, as in the words of Romer, simply irrational animus toward the unusual or the unconventional, when the moral convictions of the people, and even more rigorously, The commanding convictions and sense of obligation associated with religion, when these are excluded from that process of deliberation and decision, then the inevitable result is, if I may be permitted a phrase that I know some people think controversial, the inevitable result is the end of democracy. Now, I promised to say something in terms of the applicability of these reflections to the current question in the public square, the eruption of a conflict of rival sovereignties, namely the belated, I would say, but increasingly determined effort of Catholic bishops to hold accountable to the Lordship of Christ those Catholics who aspire to the office of Caesar. The first thing to be said about this is that the bishops are simply, however belatedly, attending to the task for which they were most solemnly ordained, which is to proclaim and to protect the Church's teaching, and to make clear what it means to be in full unity with the Church, a unity most importantly enacted in the Eucharist and the reception of Holy Communion. To the objection that the bishops are interfering in the political process, the answer is that the Catholic Church, along with most other Christians, has never accepted the odd notion that religion is an exclusively private matter. Religion is not, in the words of William James, what a man does with his solitude. To be a Catholic Christian is an intensely personal matter, to be sure, but never private. Publicly, Christ taught. Publicly, he was crucified. Publicly, he appeared in resurrected glory. Publicly, he established his church to bear witness to his present lordship and coming kingdom. Publicly, a Catholic is baptized and confirmed. Publicly, he pledges his allegiance in every Mass. And when such a Catholic then publicly and persistently and despite admonition and reproach and dialogue, when such a Catholic publicly rejects the Church's teaching and stands in ritual solemnity before the congregation of the declared enemies of the Church, of those who make it very explicit that they view the Church and its teaching as their enemy, that when that happens, and this Catholic is publicly pledging allegiance to their cause, then the bishops finally have no choice but to publicly ask, "Whose side are you on?" Now it is objected further that this exercise of pastoral duty has partisan political consequences, and that is true in part. There are, of course, plenty of pro-abortion Catholic Republicans who need to be called to account. But it is the Democratic Party that has made "Don't Give an Inch" support for the unlimited abortion license the litmus test for national leadership. The deliberate taking of innocent human life is a great evil, and the Church's protest against a great evil cannot be silenced simply because a major political party has so radically embraced that great evil. One might well ask, what would have happened if 30 or more years ago when the Catholic bishops had very significant influence with the party leadership. What if they had spoken then as some are speaking now? Or what if they had done so when John F. Kennedy in 1960 declared to the ministers of Houston the divorce of Catholic faith from public responsibility? One can speculate, interestingly, about the possible answers to such questions. But the welcome fact is that the bishops are now, however belatedly, beginning to do their duty. It is objected also, as you know, that the bishops are encouraging, quote, one-issue politics. The answer is that the deliberate taking of innocent human life is the only issue in political debate involving an intrinsic evil, that is to say, an act involving a great evil everywhere, every time, in every circumstance. That is not true of other issues in political dispute, at least not in mainstream politics, at least not between the two main parties. That is not true of tax policy. It's not true of the deficit. It's not true of U.S. actions in Iraq or a host of other issues, including capital punishment, on all of which Catholics can, in good faith, disagree. This is not simply Catholic teaching at stake, although it is very importantly brought to a public head by virtue of Catholic teaching. Moral reason, natural law, divine revelation, the Church's teaching all converge in condemning the deliberate taking of innocent human life. Abortion, how all of us wish that we did not have to be thinking about it after all these years. But it will not go away, and therefore we cannot stop thinking and talking and arguing and persuading. For abortion is not a question, emphatically not a question, of private morality. There is no more public question than the question who belongs to the community that we are obliged to protect, who belongs to the community of common responsibility. And that is precisely the question posed by abortion, by embryonic stem cell research, by euthanasia. In the lethal logic of Roe v. Wade, the court dramatically constricted the community of the legally protected, the class of the powerful against the class of the weak. And that constriction has not, these more than 30 years later, has not been democratically ratified, and I believe will never be democratically ratified. Thanks in largest part to millions of citizens, including millions of Catholics, who are willing to risk being accused of one-issue politics, knowing that on that one issue and the underlying lethal logic depends the defense of a human dignity that the state has neither the power to bestow nor the right to rescind. It is finally objected that the bishops are regressing to an earlier and presumably discarded pattern of Catholic authoritarianism. Thus, it is said, they are contributing, knowingly or not, to a revival of the old argument that Catholicism really is incompatible with American democracy. I would suggest that the exact opposite is the case. Liberal democracy flourishes when citizens engage one another, attempting to persuade one another of the truths, including the moral truths, that they deem to be authoritative. Pluralism is not, as many would have it, pretending that our deepest differences really make no difference, that we are all the same, of the same viewpoint. Pluralism is engaging our deepest differences within the bond of civility. The Church's firm teaching is that each person must act in conscience, and conscience must be informed by truth. And, of course, there are those who say, lovely sounding formula, but they respond with the question of Pontius Pilate, what is truth? And they, in responding that way, intend the question as a conversation stopper, but in fact, with that question, the democratic conversation begins and must ever begin anew. Absent that question, what is truth? There is no authentic politics. There is no possibility of democratically deliberating how ought we to order our life together. And so I conclude that the history of liberty begins with the recognition of rival sovereignties. Asked about paying taxes, he said, "Render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's." And from the history of liberty, for liberty came first, emerged through long and difficult trial and testing what we call constitutional democracy, including this American experiment. A political order that, in the words of perhaps our wisest president, is so conceived and so dedicated, such a political order will always remain an experiment. And like all experiments, it may succeed or fail. Its moments of success will always be provisional, while its moment of failure could be final. Those who, as the letter to Diognetus put it, view this America, this foreign country, as a homeland, may go further and think that it is, in terms of temporal orders, what that president called the last best hope of earth in terms of temporal orders. And precisely because many of us view it that way, and in support of that hope, we will reserve our ultimate allegiance for the city of God, for the pilgrim community that bears witness, that carries through time the promise of the coming kingdom. To paraphrase Robert Bolt's Man for All Seasons, they best serve Caesar, including the democratic Caesar, who serve Christ first. Thank you.
The microphone for you?
Way in the back there.
At the risk, is this on? At the risk of inviting any criticism of McCarrick, who I like, what did you think of his comment that he would have to sort of consult privately with a politician who, before declining the public administration of communion? If you want to comment on it, I realize you might not.
I will. I've already crossed the line on that one in the October issue of First Things, where I have an extended comment on the role of various bishops, including Cardinal McCarrick. Yes, Cardinal McCarrick said this is an issue to be fought not at the communion rail, but in the public square. And at least some people noted with gratification that apparently there's still communion rails in the Washington Archdiocese. It is understandable. The Catholic sensibility, which is in part reflected by Cardinal McCarrick and others who are essentially critical of the overwhelming majority position adopted in June in Denver by the bishops in their meeting. They are reflective of a Catholic sensibility. After all, the Catholic sensibility is not prone toward exclusion but inclusion. It is Holy Mother Church who is reaching out always to the weak and to the fallible and to the stumbling. It is, you know, the shepherd going out to seek the lost. This is the whole, it is James Joyce, that great theologian's, you know, here comes everybody. That's the Catholic Church. So there is that sensibility, and it is a good sensibility and a necessary one and deeply, deeply rooted. And there's nothing contrary to it in the role of the shepherd, the pastor, the priest, the bishop, to, with great love, not seeking confrontation, but seeking to restore to a communion that has been broken and wounded the fullness of Eucharistic solidarity. What a person decides in the church's discipline, whether it be excommunication or whether it be a much more limited discipline in order to avoid public scandal and a misrepresentation of the church's teaching. In all these cases, the decision is with the person. The decision is not with the church. The church doesn't excommunicate anybody. The church simply alerts people to what they are doing to themselves and to the consequences of what they are doing to themselves in breaking communion with the teaching and the faith and the called holiness that we are all supposed to be responding to. So I think Cardinal McCarrick, as I say in the October issue of First Things, he unfortunately strained, would be the charitable way of putting it, the trust and confidence of many bishops when he did not accurately, I choose my words with great care, did not accurately share with the bishops the guidance that Rome, and particularly Cardinal Ratzinger, wanted the bishops to have as they deliberated this question. And I think despite that, the bishops in the June meeting did show a remarkable recovery of nerve and readiness to do their duty. And I think it the more remarkable when you consider that they've just come off 2 years plus of what was commonly called, with some justification, the greatest crisis in Catholic history in the United States, the whole sex abuse crisis, in which it would have been perfectly understandable from a psychological and sociological viewpoint that the bishops would have said, let's keep a very low profile, find a little hole to hide in for a while until, you know, the winds pass by. But they didn't. And so this is potentially, I underscore potentially, a real turning point in the leadership of the Catholic Church in the United States. I pray it will be that.
You mentioned a bit about the civil public square, and I was just wondering if you would be willing to comment. I think we've all got a pretty good idea what the naked public square looks like, but just I'm interested to hear what some thoughts that you would have on what the civil public square could look like in the United States, were we able to turn around the trends of things as they are now.
Well, I think the civil public square is one that is marked by this understanding of politics that I suggested earlier with a grateful nod to Aristotle. It is a community in which people, knowing their deep differences and their deep different and deeply different understandings of the good and of the common good, are nonetheless able to respectfully engage one another within certain institutional frameworks of deliberation and decision making, such as those provided by the Constitution, and that nobody would be excluded or penalized from that conversation by virtue of insisting that his or her contribution to the answer to the question, how ought we to order our life together, is drawn from various philosophical, cultural, and religious and theological groundings. Everybody should be able to make their best argument. That's what the civil public square is. That's what the vibrantly democratic public square is. The great issues that we are being pushed into the public square, and again, Roe v. Wade being the mother of all decisions illustrating this, are decisions that have completely bypassed that kind of civil democratic deliberation, in which the court, in what Justice Byron White at the time aptly described as an act of raw judicial power, simply wiped off the books of all 50 states where, in fact, such laws existed, however variously, laws protecting the innocent and unborn. So that's, I think, those of us who are on, if you want to use the rough paradigm, pro-life, pro-choice, those of us who are in the pro-life side of this, we are the ones who must be pressing and continue to press and never tire of pressing for an authentic democratic deliberation of these questions of who belongs to the community for which we accept common responsibility, what constitutes human life, and at what points in what is undeniably human life is it appropriate to invoke a right to legal protection. These are the questions that I suppose the founders, it is true, would have been shocked and surprised to see being deliberated in the public square. They are questions that have been forced there by the judicial usurpation of politics, by the judiciary. Our constitutional order, I think one can make a good case, was not designed, it was not wired to deal with ultimate issues of good and evil, right and wrong. It presumed a constellation, a civilizational, moral, religio-cultural constellation of assumptions which were manifestly Judeo-Christian, biblical in character, dominantly Protestant and even Calvinist in their articulation. That was assumed. The Constitution did not provide for the deliberation of the question, who is a human being, for example. And indeed, at the only point at which it might have addressed that question usefully and courageously, namely at the point of slavery, it deliberately fudged that question, knowing that there could not be a successful union were that question addressed either way. But here we are. We're at a point in which we are suffering from constitutional overload, so to speak, where it was not wired to deal with ultimate questions that are being pushed upon it, and being pushed upon it not by the people, who are as firmly, I would suggest to you, by all the social survey research that we have, are as firmly within that Western Christian, Judeo-Christian, moral, biblical, and largely Protestant cultural milieu, as was the case at the American founding. But they are being pressed, of course, by the courts. And I think, as I say, the founders would have been amazed to find the abortion controversy. They would be amazed to find us debating and deliberating, presumably, over what is a family, what is a marriage. Quite astonished. Are these changes that have taken place within the culture, within the consciousness and convictions of the people with whom political sovereignty reside, I don't think that's demonstrable at all. What that they are radical interventions from the margins of the society, often pressed most vigorously and intensely by those who view the society itself and its whole political, religio-cultural history and institutions as oppressive and wrongheaded, who basically reject the American experiment in liberal democratic politics and have found an instrument to advance their radical interventions, which is to say the courts, the imperial courts, which is why no matter, I don't know what can be done about the judicial usurpation of politics. Some people just say, you know, lie back and enjoy it. This is the way it's going to be, and there's no resolution. I think we must not accept that. And that, in fact, in ways that we cannot now discern, and certainly we cannot calculate and control and schedule, there can be what Lincoln described as at Gettysburg as a rebirth of freedom, as a rebirth of the sense of the dignities and the duties that attend being participants in this audacious experiment.
Father Newhouse, your separate comments about the bishops and about judges invite the question, which I'll put in short form, what about Justice Kennedy? To put that in a somewhat longer form, we focus on politicians like Senator Kerry, but when we have judges who effectively are acting lawlessly as politicians to impose their will on the people, what is the obligation of bishops with respect to such judges?
It's a very good question, because in many ways, in the case of justice is not only in the Supreme Court, but also at other levels of the judiciary. In many cases, you have a much clearer record of their thinking by virtue of their participation in or writing of opinions, whether in majority or dissent. I think there's an enormous responsibility. I don't know who Justice Kennedy's bishop is. If he lives in this area, I expect it might be an aforementioned cardinal. But sure, there's an enormous responsibility. And anybody who says that what I say on Sunday has no bearing on what I do is my public duty, a politician who says that, you know, well, my position is and my obligation is to represent the views of my constituency, well, we know what the answer to that is in Edmund Burke's great address to the riding in Bristol, that he is obliged not to represent their views, but rather to honor their choice of him to act upon his considered views. With regard to a justice, it is even less excusable, of course, because presumably in that case, you don't have a political constituency. You're not running for re-election. Very difficult to lose your job under any circumstances. And you are simply to be obedient to the law and as constitutionally grounded. I don't know. I mean, as I said earlier, what will be done? We must recognize that even now, I mean, even after the June meeting, even after the Ratzinger intervention, even after the fine statement on politics and Catholics and political life, that it is so far at least still a minority of bishops who have, at least in any public manner, demonstrated that they are very serious about pastorally engaging such manifestly offending public figures. And but you know, courage has always been in short supply, and not only in the church, in any institution.
The mic
Could you speculate for a moment, if you will, had Cardinal McCarrick been fully forthcoming about the whole truth of Cardinal Ratzinger's July 9th letter, would the bishop's statement been substantially different? What would that have looked like had his letter been fully known? And secondly, I'm curious, because I read your column, why were the bishops so reluctant to reproach Bishop Archbishop Raymond Burke of St. Louis for his strong stance on dissenting Catholic politicians?
Mm-hmm. Well, on the first one, I mean, I know chiefly what I'm told in talking with bishops in a wide variety and from different places. I think there is a feeling that, yes, the statement would have been firmer in indicating that, as did Cardinal Ratzinger's guideline, that when all these steps have been taken of dialogue, conversation, instruction, et cetera, patiently, pastorally carried out, that then at some point that person has to know and has to be told lovingly and kindly but firmly that he should not or she should not present him or herself for communion, and that if he did, he would be refused. And that, I think, if they had had fully Cardinal Ratzinger's guidance in front of them for their deliberation, I think it more than likely that that would have been the position of the June statement, rather than making the caution not to present yourself or the warning that you would be refused simply optional, as the June statement left it. As to Archbishop Raymond Burke, the other day over at the National Press Club, we had a conference on some of these questions, and Ken Woodward, my dear friend Ken Woodward from Newsweek magazine, said that Archbishop Burke was grandstanding when he got out front on this question. Well, he's the least likely of perhaps all the bishops to grandstand. He's a extraordinarily low-key, careful, cross your T's, dot your I's, canon lawyer, who very, very deliberately, very responsibly took the actions he did, first at La Crosse, Wisconsin, because he came to St. Louis immediately after taking these initiatives in La Crosse, where he had been bishop. Were there some bishops who at the June meeting would have liked to have seen, formally or informally, a censure of Archbishop Burke for violating Episcopal fraternity by getting out front? I am told that there were a number of bishops who made clear that they would have liked to have seen Bishop Burke censured, reproached, in some sense, brought down a notch. Quite the opposite happened, and it was very, very clear, as you can see in the final vote of the for the June statement, which was 183-6, I believe, that the bishops, contrary to the view of the few who wanted to in any way censure or criticize Archbishop Burke, and contrary to Cardinal McCarrick's urging that they not take a position and postpone this whole question until after the election, it is manifestly clear that the bishops realized that Archbishop Burke had helped to alert them to the necessity of addressing this question and addressing it now, because it was, most importantly, it's a question of scandal. Now, it's a lot of non-Catholics, and for that matter, Catholics, don't know what we mean when we speak of scandal. God knows we've had enough other kinds of scandals, but when we speak about scandal in this connection, we mean not that somebody does something that's scandalous or that's odious, etc., but that it scandalizes the faithful means that it, in the most important sense, confuses and obscures and misrepresents the truth of the church's teaching. And that's finally the bishop's first obligation. You know, this was when, in 1984, when in New York, Geraldine Ferraro was running as vice president, you recall, and my dear and much lamented friend John O'Connor was the Cardinal Archbishop of New York. And you recall there was an enormous blow-up of media attention and outrage and so forth about his violating church-state, etc. But what had he done? What he had done very carefully and very judiciously, a very limited thing. Geraldine Ferraro had publicly declared on a number of occasions that you can be, that it is good Catholic teaching that you can be a Catholic and be pro-abortion. Now, what this is a grave misrepresentation of the teaching of the church. What John O'Connor did, what he had to do in that circumstance, was simply to say, just a minute, you know, I heard someone talking about what's the teaching of the Catholic Church. I'm Archbishop here in New York. You know, I have some thoughts on that, and indeed more than thoughts. And then just to, you know, set the record straight, which, of course, caused an enormous brouhaha, and always will. We're going to be, and that's the gravamen and the gist of everything I was trying to say tonight. This is a permanent circumstance of rival sovereignties constantly in various ways, and not only with the state always being at fault, not only with Caesar always being at fault, sometimes with the church and its leadership being at fault. And here, church broadly understood as all of those, at least who are the followers of the God of Israel. We're going to have this all the time. When we no longer have Americans United for Separation of the Church and State and ACLU and so forth screaming their bloody heads off over what they view as the First Amendment violations, when we no longer have this contention, then we will know that the experiment is finished and that the whole enterprise that was premised upon rival sovereignty has finally succumbed to the sovereignty of Caesar. And that will be a very sad moment, which will usher in, I believe, a much darker and much more dour prospect for the human future.
I've just recently, been to some, hear some pollsters talk about various religious views as determined through the polls, and my recollection is that the vast majority of Americans disapproved of the idea of denying a Catholic politician communion based on those views. And if I'm correct, and I really don't quite remember, but I think it was also a majority of Catholics also disapproved of that. And I'm just wondering what that says to you. Obviously, the bishops are, it's not a democracy in the sense of electing or, you know, representing your constituency in the same way, but what does it say to you, and how significant is it?
Oh, yeah. No, I think the figure is 73% of Catholics, when asked, say that they disapprove of the idea that the bishops could deny communion to anyone. And I think that that same poll attended to the variable of Catholics who are regular Mass attenders. And there, as usual on almost every issue, you have greater agreement with Episcopal leadership and particularly the Church's teaching. Having said that, what does it say? What it says is what we all know, and that is that the great majority of Catholics in the United States have not been catechized. They do not know and understand what is the teaching of the Church. With respect to this particular issue, a good many bishops have been quite explicit in saying, and I think quite right in saying, that this should be a teaching moment not only with regard to public figures and politicians who persistently live in a manner that breaks their communio with the church, but that it should be a teaching moment for all Catholics with respect to what is required and what is the circumstance appropriate to receiving Holy Communion. It has become, in the last 30, 40 years among Catholics, in most places, an assumption that to attend Mass means that you should receive Communion. And not least of the consequences of this, of course, has been to sharply produce a sharp decline in the use of the sacrament of reconciliation, of confession and absolution. The truth is that anyone who is in a circumstance of grave sin, that is, or to put it differently, not in a state of grace, and who is not spiritually disposed, properly spiritually disposed, and the person has to make that judgment, should not receive Holy Communion. Now, that is the teaching of the Church. I expect it is the case in the United States of America, we'll leave other places out for the moment, that the great majority of Catholics do not know that that's the teaching of the Church. And so there is a, as there has been a massive failure of catechesis, so there has to be the kind of renewed effort for which the Holy Father, John Paul II, over these 26 years, next month, has been calling again and again and again to evangelize and re-evangelize the Catholic people. So, and this can be a such a, quote, teaching moment, if one wants to use that phrase. It's a way of catching the attention. But we're well aware that on this and many, many other questions, the bishops, the priests, the ministry of the Catholic Church has over the last 30, 40 years massively failed to do what we are ordained to do. And renewal and genuine reform begins with that candid acknowledgement.
Shall we take one final question? And then before we have the final question, and I think the gentleman back actually has his hand before, maybe we can squeeze two in. We'll be having a wine and cheese reception out here in the lobby area afterwards with Father Newhouse. I invite you all to join us for that. Also, in the library off the lobby, there will be free copies of our outstanding new journal, The New Atlantis, available for you. It's a journal of bioethics, science, and society. Lots of very interesting articles to read. And we'll also have many of the books that we have published over the years available at a steep discount. Thank you.
You spoke earlier about the cultural and religious beliefs that presuppose our constitutional order, and I've seen you write extensively about the red and blue America, so I'd just be curious to get your assessment of the likelihood of a new birth of freedom, given the fact that at least the leadership of one of the two great political parties in the country and the free world seems to, at some level, turn its back on many of those beliefs that presupposed our constitutional order.
Right, at the risk of being partisan. No, it is certainly true that the general understanding of the founding intention and of the history of the American experiment gets that I have presented here this evening undoubtedly gets a better hearing in the Republican Party today, specifically as it relates to the questions that spill over from the penultimate to the ultimate in terms of the protection of innocent human life, but on many other issues as well. Is this election, therefore, potentially a moment of critical change? I think the answer is yes, and perhaps most importantly, having to do with the future of the judiciary and what kind of appointments in the federal and as a consequence in other levels of the judiciary in this country we're going to have for the years immediately ahead. But these really should not be. I mean, everybody says, you know, look, the argument I'm making is beyond liberal and conservative, beyond left and right. And I think it was John Fund who invented the phrase beyondism. You know, and usually he argued, and I think rightly so, that people who say that they're beyond left and right and beyond conservative, liberal, etc., are playing with a little bit of rhetorical sleight of hand. But having said that, one really has to hope, and God knows sometimes it does happen that there is an opening across these usual divides for people who may be in conflict on an awful lot of policy questions posed to understand that there is something much more important than winning and losing with respect to particular issues, and that the preservation and protection and revitalization of this kind of liberal democratic constitutional order is something that itself has a moral claim upon us. The day may come in which we can, in a way that is not so marked by bitter partisanship, engage these questions. But my hunch is that that day is not going to come until in some way the decision, the logic, and the legacy of Roe v. Wade has been removed from the center of the political stage. Roe v. Wade is the most important event in American public life in the last 30-plus years, I would say, in terms of its influence, its deep influence, in reconfiguring the religio-cultural, political, moral alignments of America. And, you know, can one envision a time in which that will not be the hot point, the point of overloading and shorting the constitutional order? Yeah, I think one can. You know, the goal, which I think is agreed upon by all responsible leaders in the pro-life movement, is that every unborn child be protected in law and welcomed in life. That's the goal that also President Bush has adopted and frequently repeats. We know that there will always be abortions, as there will be other great and evil acts. We know that that goal of every child protected in law, effectively protected in law and welcomed in life, that we will never achieve that. But that's what we move toward. Now, at some point, can the movement toward that succeed to the level of something like a political consensus across the party and other divides in our politics and culture, and thereby remove the abortion question from front center stage? I think that is conceivable. However, we have to realize that the logic of Roe v. Wade lives on and magnifies in its real and potential consequences many times over with biotechnological medical changes that are in front of us, which is one of the reasons you have to read New Atlantis, the fine magazine that Eric Cohn here edits, and which is one of the reasons why